This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL. Listen now to a talk Anthony DiMaria had with Dr. Brian Olshansky, Emeritus Professor at Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. They cover syncope, what's new.
Tell us, Brian, what's new in the guidelines regarding syncope?
Tony, thank you for allowing me to be here today to talk about the new syncope guidelines the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association have put together in collaboration with other organizations such as the Heart Rhythm Organization and several emergency room physician organizations. This is the first time that such a comprehensive and detailed guideline encompassing all studies and research and reports on syncope have been put together in a very carefully performed fashion so that we can better understand the diagnostic approach, the therapeutic approach to syncope, but also to understand how to assess risk in patients who present with syncope. And today I was talking about when to worry with regard to patients who have syncope.
You know, syncope, Brian, it's one of the most common issues confronted by the clinical cardiologist. Barely a day goes by that someone doesn't faint. And it presents a problem because it's often just vasovagal syncope innocent, but sometimes a harbinger of something really dangerous. How does the clinician go about sorting those out?
Well, you're quite right. There's the rub. How do you distinguish between the patient who is at risk for sudden cardiac death or death due to the condition that caused their syncope and the patient who has a benign form of syncope? This is a challenge, and one of the things we do know is that patients who have underlying structural heart disease, who have family histories that are consistent with some type of a familial channelopathy, patients who have cardiomyopathies with ventricular dysfunction or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, patients who have abnormalities in their electrocardiogram, patients who are athletes and are passing out during the sport, are at higher risk. And these are patients we need to pay more attention to. There is a very important algorithm we put together in the guidelines that I think all listeners should take a look at. And this really looks at the issue of first evaluating the patient who has transient loss of consciousness and determining if it is actually syncope. Second, once that determination is made, to make sure that an adequate and complete history is obtained. Now, when I say this, I mean complete. And this means to understand the circumstances that are going on, to understand how frequent it happened, to understand the comorbidities, to understand if the patient has underlying heart disease or is at risk for heart disease or may have other symptoms that could help understand the syncopal episode or other things that happened during or around the time of syncope that could explain why the patient passed out, to help understand if the problem itself is a single episode that will not recur, so it could be a situational episode, or it could be representative of a problem that's going to be recurrent but benign, or it could be representative of a problem that is benign but associated with other conditions that could be life-threatening, such as underlying structural heart disease, or it could be a problem that is actually due to the structural heart disease. So the algorithm we've put together really is a two-pronged approach to the assessment from the history and the physical and the EKG, and that is to try to help understand what is going on with syncope and understand how that is occurring in lieu of underlying risk conditions, such as the presence of underlying heart disease.
So are there some really specific issues that you look for in terms of the syncope itself, some historical factors of syncope that point you to high risk or lower risk?
Absolutely. And I just want to point out that we've looked recently at the California database of all of the admissions of patients who have come in with syncope and found that patients are getting very nonspecific evaluations at a very high cost. So the issue really here is to focus the evaluation on what the patient has and only admit patients at high risk. So, for example, I had seen a patient several years ago who was a 72-year-old lawyer, and he passed out, drove his car into a telephone pole, and almost killed himself. The first time he passed out was after he had a big meal at dinner. He stood up, and he collapsed like a sack of potatoes. When he came to see me, after he had all of the routine, ridiculous evaluation of a Holter monitor, of a carotid Doppler, of an EEG, of a CT scan, of his head, all of these things really made no sense, but they cost a lot of money, and he had multiple admissions. He told me that when he has episodes, sometimes they're preceded by drinking some cold carbonated beverage. And so I bought him a Pepsi and he drank it and he passed out in front of me while he was hooked up on the EKG. And it was pretty clear that he had deglutition syncope, and he was dumbfounded when this happened. When we made the diagnosis for 75 cents, and he said, "How did you know that that was my problem?" I said, "Well, that's what you told me." And he said, "Well, I've told the same thing to all the other doctors. Why couldn't they figure it out?" It's because they didn't listen. So listening to the patient is one of the key issues. But there are also patients that have underlying heart disease. And when they do, the evaluation has to be focused. So if a patient presents with loss of consciousness, who may have multiple things found on physical history, but if they were like sitting in a chair, for example, and they had a history of a myocardial infarction, and they had an ejection fraction in the 40% range, while the diagnosis may not be so clear about what is going on here, the red flags are going up because of his anterior infarction, because of his ventricular dysfunction, and because he passed out in a supine position. This is a patient you need to worry about. You may not have a diagnosis, but this is a patient that needs to be admitted to the hospital and evaluated. And the evaluation is not going to be a Holter monitor, a CT scan, and an EEG. But it may require specialized testing like an electrophysiology test, which this patient had, and he had inducible ventricular tachycardia. And so the evaluation, as we have laid it out in the guidelines, is very specific based on what's found on the history and the physical. And the history has to be very carefully performed, as well as getting any old records that you can possibly find.
Let's assume you have a patient who faints, not in any unusual circumstance, in terms of post-micturition or anything like that, and you do your history and your physical and really don't come up with any evidence of disease, neurologic or cardiologic. Are there some tests that should be done in this patient at a minimum, even though you think this is simple vasovagal syncope?
Yes, I do think that in some cases, yes, but in other cases, no. If the history is completely consistent with vasovagal syncope in a young person, that may be all you need. But for an older person, let's say over the age of 50, in which there was sudden collapse without any explanation, at least an electrocardiogram and then further evaluation based on suspicion. But much of the evaluation can be performed as an outpatient if the suspicion is low. And this is built into the guidelines. And so in our very few seconds remaining, let me just summarize what I would have to say about that. And that is, when you see a patient with syncope, it's very important to get a careful and complete history. This is going to be critical, not only from the patient, but from the family. Also, it's going to be important to get any old records and understand anything about the disease entities that that patient may have, and then figure out if those diseases could somehow interplay with the episode of syncope that you just saw, and then perform a risk assessment as well as an evaluation of what you might think is the mechanism responsible for syncope. And the two of them may be linked, but they may not. And so it may be a two-pronged approach to evaluate the syncope mechanism and to evaluate the underlying condition. But with that said, the case that you are talking about of a person in whom you do not know what the mechanism may be, but there is nothing seriously found, The evaluation can be performed rather leisurely as an outpatient rather than admitting the patient and doing a variety of tests that become ultimately unnecessary.
Would those tests include an echo or a stress test?
It very well may, depending on the patient.
Or some ambulatory monitoring, perhaps, depending
Absolutely.
On the patient. Okay, well, clearly a focus on the importance of history in pointing toward low-risk versus high-risk patients, the high-risk patients having comorbidities and or underlying cardiac disease. I'll take your point that very often patients are admitted to the hospital, subjected to extensive evaluations when really they only had a simple vasovagal syncope. But for many of us, there may be a group where we're not quite sure, and we'll go on to do some testing. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tony.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.